Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Catherine Gentile about her novel, Sunday's Orphan. In the current climate, with the renewed attention being paid to the need for racial justice, Sunday's Orphan offers a stark portrait of how deep the roots of racial injustice have been in the United States. Set in rural Georgia in 1930, the novel follows the story of Promise Mears Crawford, who has just inherited 50 acres of land from her guardian Taylor, a utopian visionary. Death, thou intractable agent, just and eternal finale, after a life of enduring lies, you advance doggedly, you arrive too soon. Taylor Crawford, My Life in Georgia, 1929. Promise plunged her shovel into the sandy Georgia soil and splintered the last fence post her uncle Taylor had hewn, marking the first page of her history since he had died. Etched in her memory was the layout of the property which embodied his life's work. To the north, Taylor's newly dug graves, situated, as he'd requested, alongside the graves of the slaves who had worked this plantation long before he came to own it. To the south, vegetable gardens. To the east, the cornbread footpath that meandered through the woods and past the inconspicuous structures housing the farm's workers and their families. And to the west, the pasture dotted with a small barn in which she sheltered animals recovering from a predatory assault. From where she stood within walking distance of Taylor's grave, she could see past the smokehouse and drought-stunted corn plants, over the bean and okra fields, to the lean-to beside the small barn. There stood the imposing figure of Fletch Hart, Uncle Taylor's 24-year-old foreman, who, after Taylor's passing, had reluctantly agreed to work for her. He looked up from his workbench, where he'd been repairing the latch on a birdcage, and for the first time in the 20 years they'd known one another, made no move to wave or call her name. And now, please join me in welcoming Catherine Gentile. Hi, Catherine. I look forward to talking with you today.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Do start by telling us a bit about your background and how you got into writing fiction.
Oh, heavens. I've written fiction most of my life, and I think as a young child, I was a rather decent storyteller, and that was stories that were told out loud, of course, and depending on the situation, adjusting stories to fit the situation. And I had my first play actually produced when I was in sixth grade, and a second play when I was in eighth grade, neither of which is merits talking about, but it's just when I think back, I was actually writing at a very early age, writing stories and trying to turn them into something that other people would enjoy vis-a-vis plays and so forth. So I've written all my life, and I've kept journals, and it wasn't until I was in my 50s that I really was able to dedicate the type of time I wanted to writing. And I realized it was so much a part of me that I needed to do something. And I've been writing ever since.
You've also published a short story collection called Small Lies and a fictionalized memoir, The Quiet Roar of a Hummingbird. What can you tell us about those works?
Well, let's see. The Quiet Roar of the Hummingbird was the first novel that I wrote. And it's, as you said, it's a fictionalized memoir. It was about my family's journey with my mom, who had Alzheimer's for 13 years. And I wrote the book to kind of consolidate a lot of the information that we had encountered in our journey. And at that time, that was prior to 2013. So that was 13 years prior to that. There wasn't a lot of support for persons who had Alzheimer's nor their families. So this was something to offer people to give them some notions of ways they could approach and issues that they would encounter. So that was that one. And it kind of wrote itself because I spent a lot of time with my mom at a memory care facility. And as we were, you know, the hours would go by, the stories would go through my head. And by the time I sat down at the computer, it kind of felt like the book wrote itself. So that was an interesting experience for me, and it was a cathartic experience also. So I found it kind of healing. And the second publication, as you mentioned, was Small Lies, the collection of short stories. And at that time, there was so much going on in the world. I was trying to capture stories. I was trying to capture events in the world in short stories. And I captured some that were worldwide. I mean, one story takes place in Afghanistan. There's a piece that has a Denmark piece in it. And I also captured stories that were close to home. So they were bits and pieces of that type of material. But what I found was that in each story, there were some sort of a lie, some sort of an untruth, and the characters had to deal with what was going on there. So that's what brought the stories together.
And where does Sunday's Orphan come from? What drew you to this story?
Well, I've always been interested in racism and curious about it because I grew up side by side with kids who were Negro kids, we called them back then. And, you know, we were curious about one another. I mean, I wondered why the little children had very lovely curly hair and I had, you know, less curly hair. My hair is curly, but not like theirs. And they wondered why my skin was so white. And I went home to my dad and I asked him what was going on. Why were they a different color and I was white? And he, being an artist, said to me, because they had a different pigmentation in their skin and they had more of one sort of pigmentation than I did. And to me, that was a fine answer. And to the rest of the kids, they seemed okay with that. So we grew up side by side and it wasn't an issue. I mean, that was right through high school. And then I began to realize things weren't so easy in the world. And I continued to wonder about, you know, where is it coming from? Is this something we created? And then things like Emmett Till, of course, caught my attention, and things that happened to this wasn't a racial issue, but it certainly was a prejudicial issue having to do with Matthew Shepard. And I just thought the violence that comes out of this is just astounding. So I think I may have written it to try to help myself understand what causes people to move into violent reactions to people being very different from themselves.
Did you have personal experience of the Jim Crow South, or did you do research for it? And if so, how did you go about it?
You know, a lot of writers come up to Maine and they vacation or they have a summer home here, and they wind up writing stories about the vacation area. And I had the same experience, except I went down south. I went to Georgia and vacationed there a number of times. And I was fascinated with the area. There's something about the South that entrances me. And maybe it's just because it's such a different area than Maine. But I became very interested in the culture down there and very interested in doing some research about Jim Crow. And that's what started me on this story. And I did a lot of research, book work, internet work. I talked to people at different universities and got tapes that they had put together that helped me in different aspects for the story. And the other thing was I went back and I visited with, like many authors do, with a notebook full of questions. So once I realized what I needed to know for the story and what I didn't have a good handle on, I went back and I had wonderful, wonderful assistance by librarians and citizens who were very interested in telling me their stories. So it was a fascinating experience, and I found how much I love doing the research. I love having that as my focus when I'm writing a story. I just can't wait to get into the next one.
Well, we'll talk about that before I let you go, but let's talk about this one for a moment. Your heroine, whose first name is Promise, has inherited a piece of land with a remarkable history that sets it apart from the properties around it. So fill us in on her guardian, Taylor Crawford, and his vision of racial harmony.
Taylor was a graduate of the Harvard School, which was at that time, I don't know if it was called back then, but it was essentially a school of divinity. And so he was a Reverend Taylor Crawford, and he had some very different ideas about racial harmony, essentially that all should be one. And this idea was different than the ideas maintained by his colleagues in Boston. And he was a very vocal proponent of that. He was eventually driven out of the Harvard arena, the Boston arena, and he went down south and had a good friend, Will Hart, with whom he found this piece of fallow land. It was the part of an enormous plantation, only 50 acres, but he purchased it. And there he set up what he determined would be his utopian vision. And that was a place where blacks and whites could live on the same property, work together and live together in harmony, and that everyone would be educated. And that's exactly what he did. He was an educator, and he educated all the folks on his plantation, and including Promise. So he was a very influential character, and he managed to maintain the peace on his plantation. And that was at great cost, which is what the story is about.
So Promise's identity turns out to be a much more complicated question than we know at the beginning of the novel. But tell us about her as your main character, as she's portrayed at the beginning of the novel. Who is she, and how would you describe her as a personality?
Well, she is a very confident, self-possessed woman. She's been raised since an infant by her, what we call her adoptive uncle, and that was Taylor. He was not a blood relative. And he adopted her and raised her by himself. And he did not discriminate in terms of watering down whatever she had to learn or do because she was a woman. He sat her down side by side with a couple of the other characters in the book, the men, Fletch Hart and his brother Trivet Hart, and taught all of them the same. So she was confident, she was self-reliant, and she was independent, and she had a lot of skills. And she could run the farm. She trained animals. She healed animals. She especially worked with animals that were broken in spirit and quite unruly. So I found her to be a competent lady. She was also taught to think and to observe, and this served her well as the story unfolded.
And what does she want from her life at this point?
Well, one of the things she wanted, when the story opens, she's really in mourning. She's lost Taylor Crawford, her adoptive uncle. He had passed away, and he had left her with a farm that she thought was in better shape financially, and was not. And he had made some promises to people on the farm that he would support them and support their future careers, and he could not do that, or she could not do that now as the person who inherited the farm. So she was dealing with, how do I manage that piece? And dealing with why would Taylor even leave a mess like that? It was unlike him. So she was disappointed with him, probably a little bit angry at him, annoyed. And her friendship, which had been very dear with Fletch Hart, who was the foreman of the farm, had been compromised. And this was, again, Taylor's doing.
Soon after we meet her, she's presented with an additional dilemma in the person of Daffron Mears. Do you say it as Mears?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Who is he? What does he want from Promise? And why does she give in to his demands?
Well, he is a character who has not been part of her life all her life. So she's 20 years old and she's never met him before. She's heard about him. He's a dastardly character. He's known as what they called a Jim Crow enforcer. And that was somebody who really took the Jim Crow laws to heart and made sure that people were following what the laws prescribed. And these are unwritten laws, of course. And was known to have killed people to keep them, to maintain fear and to keep that in their lives. So when he showed up on her farm shortly after, after the story opens, and of course, after Taylor had died, he comes on the scene and she is with Fletch, who is a Negro, and it's quite obvious they're working together, which they had always done. But in Jim Crow law, a white woman and a black man were not to be together unescorted or unchaperoned. So she knew that she was in trouble when he showed up, and he kind of knew her soft spot. He knew that if he asked for a job, she would have to acquiesce. And while she tried to avoid it, she ultimately did. She offered him a job, but only for a week. And she did that because she knew that if she did not offer him a job, then he would certainly make something, a big deal, out of the fact that she was alone with Fletch. So to protect Fletch, she went ahead and did this, but it led to further complications, of course.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Tell us a little bit more about Fletch Hart. He might be considered a protege of Taylor's, and he's in a difficult position, as you just indicated, and a little reluctant to work for Promise. What's his story?
Well, he is a brilliant young black man. He's 24 years old, and he has been tutored by Taylor all his life, and he has been accepted at Harvard at their medical school. And Taylor was grooming him to become a physician, and Taylor's plan was that Fletch Hart would come back and tend to the medical needs of the people on the island. And it looked as if his future was going to be quite promising until Taylor died, and the funds to help provide for the tuition at Harvard were not there. So Fletch kind of assumes that Promise has had something to do with those funds being unavailable because she didn't want to let him go. She didn't want to see him leave. And I think hurt and disappointment was a lot of his was in his psyche, and it prompted him to probably make some decisions about Promise that were not quite accurate, not quite in keeping with who she was. Nonetheless, their friendship is put to the test, and he's rather standoffish, which is very unusual for him.
He's particularly unhappy, too, with the arrival of Daffron, and for good reason.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about their relationship, perhaps, and how it's affected by the Jim Crow, the reality of the Jim Crow laws.
The relationship between Promise and Fletch?
Well, either that or the relationship between Fletch and Daffron.
Well, essentially, they have no immediate relationship other than that particular meeting at the farm on that day. But it's a fear. It's a relationship of fear. Fletch knows who this fella is. He knows that he has the reputation of brutally murdering black people. And he knows that they're now in trouble. So he's smart enough to know that the years he spent on this farm with Taylor were special years, and that I think Fletch sees those years, the protection of those years, he sees them dissipate right in front of his eyes when Daffron shows up. So, you know, Fletch is not only worried about himself, he's worried about Daffron finding out that he's been promised to go up to Harvard, that his mother, Mother Hart, is living on the farm, an elderly woman, and that there are other black families on the farm as well. So he's quite concerned about what's going on and what this man's presence means.
His mother, Fletch's mother, that is the town midwife, and she is quite an important character in the book, too. Can you tell us a bit about her?
She is a grounding character, and by that I mean that people, black and white, look to her for a sense of perspective, for a sense of good old common sense, for a sense of things are going to be okay. And when things go a little awry, people look to her and her wisdom for a plan. What are we going to do about this, and how are we going to do it? And she usually manages to support them quite effectively. And as the story is opening, we start to see Mother Hart as we move into the story, and she is not doing quite as well as her reputation would lead one to believe or lead one to expect. So she's somebody who is very, very profoundly affected by Daffron's appearance.
As you've mentioned, Daffron has overseen various lynchings even before the novel begins, and there is one within the first quarter of the book, which is a particularly painful element of the history, but also your novel. What can you tell us about this part of the story and why you chose to include it?
Well, you know, when I first wrote the story, I did not include it. And I thought about it, but it's ugly. It's painful. I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to do that as a writer. You know, you're writing, you sit at a desk and you sit with your material and your characters for hours on end, and they become part of your own psyche in that it's just an intense relationship. So I had no desire to do that, to talk about it. And my writing group reviewed my material, and they said to me, you know, it's like the shotgun that you put on the mantelpiece in the opening scene. If you've got a shotgun there, you have to use it. And so my shotgun was Daffron, and they insisted, nope, you've got to go down that road. So I did. And thank goodness I've had no direct experience with that level of violence. But I certainly had to do the research, and it's amazing the research that is out there, the information that is out there on this, horrible, horrible, type of violence, and including photographs and all sorts of very, very graphic material. So, yeah, it was very hard to write. And I think what it ultimately did, and this is how I looked at it, is, you know, maybe we all need to understand that life is not quite as sanitized as the way we live it now, and that people, even to this day, there are people who are encountering this fear on all sorts of levels. So it had its place in its in the story, reluctantly, but yes, it's there.
Yes, it must have been excruciating to write.
Yeah, it was not fun. It was not fun.
So two other characters who are mentioned early in the book and soon make an appearance are Andrew Gills and his sister Ellen, who both come from Boston. Taylor Crawford had picked Andrew out as Promise's husband and considered leaving the property to him rather than to Promise. What caused those plans to change?
We're not quite sure, and this is through Promise's eyes. Taylor, as he got closer to death, he was quite ill, seemed to become somewhat irrational. He couldn't quite decide how he wanted to manage this empire, this small empire on the plantation that he had built. And I think he was, his concern was, how do I control this beyond? How do I make sure that they continue with my legacy? And I think he was probably deciding who would be the best person to continue with that legacy. And I think he was trying to weigh what the pros and cons would be. And Andrew certainly brought money and financial savvy to the situation. But I don't think he brought heart. I think he was more about Andrew. And Promise was certainly about whatever Taylor wanted, and his maintaining the plantation as he had had it. So I think he ultimately went with her for that reason. I'll leave that at that.
So in a sense, that answers my next question, but I'm curious just to hear about it from a writer's point of view. Would it have made a difference to the people in your story if Andrew had inherited the farm and married Promise? Why did you make a different choice?
I think the story would have ended. Andrew and his sister were well-heeled. They were from Boston. They were not farmers. You know, he was really not terribly interested in anything having to do with farming other than horses. And the reason he was interested in horses was because he was a gambler. He liked racehorses. And Ellen was at the other end of the spectrum, a little more lofty, but still within a very encapsulated, comfortable view of the world. So she could be very liberal. And her liberality came in trying to promote an anti-lynching law. She tries to promote this law, and she does so. She's effective within her circles. She's working on pulling together a conference or working at a conference. And so she's quite committed to it, but she's also unusual, or she's usual, other people have told me, people who have been in these circumstances, in that she excludes Black people from something that has to do with Black people. So you kind of wonder where her heart is at. So between the two of them, Andrew and Ellen, I, as an author, did not see them as being genuine enough to continue with the story along their line. It would have had a very, very different trajectory. And that wouldn't have been comfortable for me to even think about.
There are lots of other characters and incidents that I haven't mentioned. Suzanne and Margaret, for example, among the characters. Is there anyone or anything you'd particularly like readers to learn about?
Well, I think just to share something from an author's perspective, and that is that I found the story is a difficult story, as we've spoken about. And I, as an author, I found it difficult to be with these people, these characters, day in and day out. And I needed someone who was going to be add a little levity to the story. I mean, not hilarity by any means, but a little bit of levity and a little bit of innocence. And that came about through the character of AC, who is Margaret's brother. And Margaret, by the way, is Daffron's wife. So between Daffron's brother-in-law, AC, and also his daughter, Beatty, there's just some injection of innocence, and it's innocence that gets tainted, which is difficult. But nonetheless, there's innocence there, and to me, that offered some hope. And it was enough to keep me feeling comfortable and fluid about my writing, and to give me something to think about other than the difficulties that these characters were encountering.
That's an interesting take. Tell us a little bit more about Margaret, actually. What's it like to be Daffron's wife?
You know, Margaret lived with Daffron prior to marriage, and the mother heart suspects that she became pregnant, and that's when the marriage ensued. Mother heart pretty much mourned the fact that Margaret, who she thought was quite a lovely human being, got stuck with Daffron, if you will. And her life was not an easy one. I think she had basically what she needed in terms of a roof over her head, but she kind of lived in squalor. And I think she had a suspicion as to who Daffron really was. He wasn't home a lot. He had been pretty much driven out of the area by Taylor. And so he was in and out of her life. But I think she got an inkling as to what this person was about, and she was actually able to help crack open what was going on with him and what he had been doing. And she and Mother Heart joined forces to help bring him down. So she's not a major character, but she's important in that she really knew somebody who had a major piece in the story.
What would you like people to take away from Sunday's Orphan?
Oh, heavens. You know, what I saw in the story was a remarkable sense of love that came across through particularly Mother Heart. And by that, I mean that she gave totally of herself to the point of losing her sanity, essentially. And she had to keep a lot of information. I mean, Black people and white people shared information with her that they would never share with anybody else. And she was known to never, never breathe a word of all of these things. And that included information about her own life. So I think she had a tremendous amount of love. She tried to protect everyone in her family. And she really sacrificed herself to that end. So I think about the power of love being something that we give to someone else or for other purposes, and that violence really has no place. It's part of our lives, but when you consider how human nature thrives, the conditions under which it will thrive, it does not thrive when violence is a part of life. So I think it's a book about two things, love and compassion and mercy and violence. And that's how I look at the book.
You mentioned that you're working on something else. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have a couple of nonfiction projects going on. I write a monthly e-zine for persons, caregivers of persons with neurological issues, Alzheimer's and other types of dementia, and Parkinson's, that type of thing. So I work on that at a regular basis. There's some interesting things happening in that realm right now. I'm also working on a what I hope will become my next novel, and it has to do with it's set in Maine and has to do with a young fellow, Japanese fellow post interment here in the United States. So I've been working on that for a while. I'm going to go back to that. And I have another historical fiction that I'm going to start researching, and that's going to be set in Europe in the Middle Ages. And that's been something that's been on my mind for a long time, so I'm looking forward to getting into that.
That's a wide range there. Anywhere particular in Europe?
I'm thinking Belgium, perhaps Germany, but yeah. Yeah, I haven't quite decided how I have to work out. You know, it's interesting. Stories to me come very organically. So I rarely decide on one piece and say, well, that's it, and everything emanates from that. All the pieces have to fit together. So I have to get a better idea of what I want to do with those pieces or what those pieces want to do with me before I can pinpoint exactly where it's going to be set.
Well, I wish you luck, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us today, Catherine.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's been a delight.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Catherine Gentile about Sunday's Orphan. Find out more about her at www.catherinegentile.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Network. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.